to amrap.org.au.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network to over 70 community stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, hosted by Lisa Dano Daniel, coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Hi, welcome to Word for Word. I'm your host, Lisa Dano Daniel. Today's guest is Michelle McNamara. Besides being involved in a wide variety of transgender and inclusion focus groups, Michelle is also an Enterprise Fellow in the School of Biosciences and teaches in a Master of Biotechnology course at the University of Melbourne. Michelle came out as a transgender woman later in life, is happily married with two adult children, and is a practicing Buddhist. Welcome to Word for Word, Michelle McNamara.
Thanks, Lisa.
Now, we're going to delve into your life today, Michelle, and find out all sorts of things about you.
And I love talking about myself, Lisa.
Good. Well, that's good. Now, let's start by placing you in a decade. What decade were you born in? I don't want to be ageist or anything like that, but it's sometimes useful to place the guests in a decade.
We can pin it down to a year. I'm not coy about it. Queen Elizabeth was on the throne. The molecular structure, the 3D molecular structure of DNA was published 10 days before I was born. I was born in April 1953. It was a very significant year. Christine Jorgensen had her operation a year ago and had come out in the US at that point to media fanfare.
Was she probably the most famous trans person in the 50s only?
I would say she was the most famous. There were others before her, but she made a really big splash in the US, got a lot of media attention around the world, and she became known as kind of the first celebrity trans person, I guess.
Because I remember Renee Richards in the sporting arena, that sort of thing. What was she, sort of 80s?
70s, I think.
70s, 80s?
She played Billie Jean King. Her origins are rooted in the 1950s. I went to a Catholic school. I grew up in Ivanhoe. I have a younger sister, so it was quite an outer suburban experience at that point, really.
So when you were there, was it, in terms of an outer suburb as it was then, was it the sort of place that kids played in the street and, you know, kind of had their free rein in the suburb and that sort of thing?
Absolutely. Our block had a fairly steep drive. We had billy carts and you just roll down the drive into the street. You know, you go and kick the footy in the street or play cricket at the end of the street. It was just very much that kind of freewheeling kind of life.
Would you say you came from a close-knit family? Were you close with your sister, being the older sibling? Were you in charge?
Yes, I think that the relationship with my sister is quite complex and has changed over the years. When we were young, certainly my memory was that my sister didn't really speak proper discernible English till she was about four. I used to interpret for her all the time, so we were quite close. You know, I was interpreting what she was saying. We've grown very distant of late and we don't really speak anymore, so been an interesting evolution there. And it's not really anything to do with me being trans.
Families are very complex institutions.
Extraordinary, quite complex. And to talk about that family being close, I think it's not, you wouldn't describe us as a close family.
Has that changed? So your parents have passed away?
Yes, they passed away.
Yeah. And has your relationship with your sister changed since then?
We were on not very good terms before that, and after they passed away, we've hardly spoken at all. Quite a difficult period. We were already in difficulties before that, so.
You know, there's two of you in the family. Your parents are no longer. Is that kind of hard to not have a close relationship, or is it something that you've just kind of, you know, it's evolved and it's something that is just the way it is now?
I think the latter. I think it's just the way it is. I don't reflect on it too much because I've got plenty of other things to reflect on. There's plenty of other challenges in my life at the moment, and it's something, you know, COVID has been an extraordinary period during lockdown where we've had lots of opportunities to go into ourselves because we've been so by ourselves. I certainly, the complex mental state that I've had during that period, somewhat of anxiety and so on, has been amplified by considering all these kind of relationship issues, and I've just taken a conscious decision to shy away from it for now, not forever, but for now, to just put it down and say, you got to get through this, Michelle, and live an enjoyable life, live a reasonable life, and take on challenges that you can actually meet comfortably.
I'm going to seize on the phrase "not at the moment" or "not now" that you just said about your sister. So, is it something that you might revisit? at some stage in your life?
Well, I was thinking even beyond my sister, the whole question of family relationships, the whole question of why I am the way I am now, and all that complexity that comes from very early childhood through growing up, through young adulthood, etc., into old age, which is where I'm now. I think that the reflection on that and the reflection on my relationship with my sister will be part of it, is something that I will come back to. But it's just something that I need to, I'm going through a period of my life where I need to ground myself in myself before I start to reach out too much.
Do you think COVID changed things for you in terms of giving you a different level of introspection?
Yes, I think it's given me a much greater level of introspection. I suppose, you know, my Buddhist practice really encourages you to understand yourself. It's a very important part of the Buddhist practice, and I'll go to my favourite quote. There's a Zen Buddhist master from the 12th century, a Japanese called Dogen, and I paraphrase this badly, but he said, "To study the Buddha way is to study the self, and you study the self to forget the self." Buddhism is really about letting go, and letting go of holding on to yourself as something that is unchanging and constant, and examining its changingness and its inconstancy, and examining that is part of the path, belief in the path to liberation. So part of the actual practices that I've been studying coincidentally with lockdown, or maybe it was by design by these teachers, has been really around getting to know myself more on the physical level and the mental level, I guess. And that has led me down the path of more introspection about my early life and my family life and so on. I have done a lot of introspection about more recent years some time ago, and I think that introspection that I did before I transitioned to Michelle led to Michelle's transition. It really started to strip away that male persona that I'd put on, that male mask that I'd put on, started to fall away as I started to examine it in more detail. And what emerged was Michelle came through almost as a single breakthrough and a single event. All of a sudden, there she was, and I had no way of controlling coming out. I simply had to come out and did so. So that's a long, long answer to that simple
it's
question.
A very good answer.
But really, I have a deep belief that the Buddhist practices and work that I've done has led to, well, it does demand a lot of introspection of yourself, and has led to me coming out and being where I am today. I think that during the COVID period, there was a lot of anxiety in general. I think everybody experienced anxiety. I certainly experienced anxiety about the thought of catching COVID and having some health issues that would lead me to be susceptible to serious COVID. I was quite seriously frightened. That anxiety is not a good state to start examining past and issues that may make you, in fact, more anxious. And so I found that as I started to do these practices of examining, and which led to me examining myself in my formative years, it was creating a level of anxiety that was unbearable, and I just simply had to stop. I must say that I was working with a therapist at that stage as well. As a result of the increasing anxiety, I started working with a therapist, and they were encouraging me to go into this more deeply, and I think that was probably a bad thing, and I made the decision to stop. It is a good thing to do, and it will ultimately be needed if I'm, you know, to help me move forward, but not now. Just stop now and, you know, keep yourself together, you know.
It sounds like a wise decision, you know, given the way the world has been over the last, well, year, really, almost a year. I want to get to the bottom of what it's like for you as going to a Catholic school. Were you a good student? Were you a popular kid? Did you like school?
Interesting set of questions. I think, again, I could give you some short answers, or we can take the long way around, whatever you like. Let's go long. Okay, so I guess my first 4 years, 5 years of school, perhaps 1, 2, 3, 4, were at a coeducational Catholic primary school, so boys and girls in the same class, not necessarily in the same part of the classroom, but we could mix fairly freely. They were big classes, so I was in a started out school in a prep 1, 2 combined class. There were 60 children in it, one teacher, and the next one was a composite 3, 4. 60 or so students. It was quite big classes, almost unimaginable today, I would think, to teachers. Ruled with iron fists or whatever. Very little room for dissent against the teacher, you know, had to be controlled. I really enjoyed the fact that it was a mixed class because I knew at that stage very, very clearly that I was female. It was a total mistake to regard me as a boy.
So is that about, say, about seven?
Yeah, six even.
So. Six and seven is the number that I hear in here a lot in terms of both gender and sexuality, actually.
You know, a lot of people sort of to say it's even earlier. I've got the feeling that it was very much earlier. I mean, six or seven is the age that I can remember back to, but I think it was probably much earlier. I distinctly remember on the first time I spoke in public, Georgie Stone and her mother, Rebecca Robertson, spoke in the same thing, and they both tell the same story about the first time that they knew Georgie was trans, and she was 2 and a half.
That was the bath scene.
Georgie said to Mum, "Mummy, I want a vagina. I want a vagina." And Rebecca goes, "Well, that's nice, dear." Saying, "I'm thinking, oh my gosh, what do I do about this? Is it going to persist?"
And I think maybe.
And so I've got that feeling that you know, that inside me, because I can't remember any further back than that first feeling of being female. And, you know, I've talked about it in public before. So, you know, the first memory that I've got is having my mother's dress on and her shoes that I was flopping around in. I had a bit of her makeup on, lipstick or powder, and looking at myself in the mirror and thinking, wow, that's just how I should be. That's me. That's great. It was at the same once shocking and once wonderful, both together.
Yeah, we get the sense somewhere, don't we? Even if it's not spoken about in terms of what your mother possibly said to you.
Oh, yes. I mean, this is total supposition. It can be absorbed through the media in various ways, although, you know, I probably didn't start properly engaging with media until I was 7 or so, because limited access to radios, no TV, can't remember the first film I saw, but, you know, there would have been limited input from media until I started to read at about 7.
Yeah, you would have been presented with a very binary idea of gender growing up in the 50s and 60s.
Oh, my gosh, yes. You know, the story I'd love to tell is, you know, sometime about 1964 or 5, I can remember we came home from church on Sunday morning. You know, we're sitting around the table, Mum's getting the roast ready, and, you know, she's talking to Dad, and she said, "Did you see that brazen hussy in front of us at the church? She was wearing slacks." And, you know, the fact that I think women would wear jeans, trousers, whatever, slacks in those days, but my mum was still umbraged at the fact that she was wearing them in church. It would have taken Mum probably a decade or 15 years before she would have worn slacks to church, but she definitely did wear slacks to church ultimately. But just thinking back, you know, that it wasn't considered acceptable for women to wear trousers at all in that period in the 50s, that there was something a bit dodgy, that, you know, it was a brazen hussy. Wonderful phrase.
There's actually a
terrible misogynist phrase, in fact.
There's a great documentary about feminism in Australia that's just out at the moment called Brazen Hussies. So.
You know, that, do you tell that story to illustrate, you know, it's just how binary gender was, you know, that there's still storms when, what's his name, Styles wore
a dress
on the front of Vogue, you know. There's still a storm about that today, you know.
Yeah,
men wearing dresses are a really, really big thing, you know.
And women get away with a lot more than men.
And women have fought hard for it through, you know, female, you know, men's liberation. It's just been extraordinary, and I'm so grateful for them having changed gender or moved to an outward expression of being female. I'm just so grateful for them, to all the work that they've done in all areas of life. It's been so important.
Yeah, we have so many people before us to be thankful for. So tell me about how you dealt with your gender over the years, because you were late at coming out in your...
Incredible. I was 60 by the time
60,
I came out.
Which is, again, something I hear and hear a lot, and older.
How did I cope with my gender? So at the age... Well, just continue with the school story. So at grade four, in grade five, my parents decided to move me to my father's old school, which was a, you know, combined primary and secondary school. So in grade five, I went into that school, boys' own school, and I kind of blended in okay, I guess. I moved in. I loved being in the choir. I had a beautiful soprano voice. I was just really loved it, you know, and I so enjoyed doing all sorts of singing, religious chants, all sorts of stuff, you know. We'd sing at masses and we'd sing at the Stedfords. And late that year, so I was 10, what happened is my voice started to break. And we were going to the big final at Stedford for the year, a big competition, and we were practicing. And I still remember being pulled out by the choir master and said, "You, out." And that was it, you know. It was literally like that. And at that point, my world started to crumble, because I'd lost not just that beautiful thing of being part of a choir, that great communal thing, that great enjoyment of a voice. I had this weird voice that was going all over the place.
Did he?
But there was part of that in me said, you know, that's destroying your ability to be female, to be a woman, you know. And it was the beginning of the beginning of puberty, in fact. And I shot up almost overnight to the current height that I am, or a little bit higher than the current height that I am, which is 6 foot and 1.8 meters to the younger listener. And I started growing a beard, started having to shave late that following year. So it took about a year. But I was just enormous. And that was also another thing that, you know, women of my age, 6 foot women of my age, are a rarity, absolute rarity. Not so today. And certainly having this bristly beard was not a good thing. So how did you feel
about your body then?
I felt really bad, you know. Going through puberty is hard for anyone. I get that. But going through puberty into the wrong gender is just a nightmare. And I, just over that whole period, you know, I, with really great reluctance, I had to say, "Michelle, you've got to put it away. You can't. You've got to put away this idea that you're a girl. You've got to suppress it. You've got to hide it." Of course, sitting behind that is that binary view of the world that existed, of course, and that the thought of crossing the binary was ridiculous. And also, you've got to remember that in those days, even slightly feminine men got bashed regularly. You know, you could read about it in the papers quite unhappily, and you could see it, you know, and the jokes that were being made. I was in grade six, I think, and, you know, I got called, one of the school bullies started calling me a great big fairy and poofter and stuff, and "What about your bloody poofter mates," or something, you know. I got this sort of abuse in the playground. And of course, they were, you know, 5 foot nothing, and I was 6 foot. So I just turned around and said, you know, once they started abusing my friends, I thought, no, that's not what's going to happen. And I just turned around and flattened them, not hit them, but just overpowered them, put them on the ground and said, "You're not going to do that, otherwise you're going to cop it."
Was that the sort of thing you could take to, you know, a teacher or a parent, that you were being bullied in that way?
No way. I would have been absolutely terrified to do that and wouldn't have even considered it, but recognised that I needed to do something about it. And I'm grateful now that I had the power to do it, because trans friends that I know of a similar age who have the blessed physical attribute of being much shorter suffered an enormous amount of bullying because they just didn't have the physical size that I have to protect themselves. And I recognise that even though my physical size is a problem, it was in fact a bit of a blessing. So gradually over that period from 12 to through 13, 11, 12, 13, I just gave up the whole idea of being Michelle, and it was quite difficult.
Did you have that name picked out in your mind?
No,
way back then.
No, I'm using my girl name. I shouldn't be shy about, you know, my male name's Michael, and I'm not shy about it. And no, I didn't have that. That name came only to me when I was coming out. I just said, simply said to myself, "What's the easiest feminine of Michael you can get? Michelle, fine, it's a lovely name. I like it. You know, I'm a bit of a Francophile, so, you know, Michelle ending was nice."
I guess it might have been a step too far as a 12-year-old to have a female name
head. You mean, yes.
Because that would confirm it somehow.
Yeah, I certainly did borrow my mother's clothes and dress in them from time to time, and whenever I got the opportunity, and envisaged all sorts of lives that might have been, but I don't know. It just didn't even seem to be a possibility. And of course, even at 12, I didn't really know anybody that anybody else was trans. I had no, even though Christian Jorgensen and there was some background of people out there, it wasn't generally known. And I was, one day I was sitting in the barbers in East Malvern near my near my parents' new house, and I picked up an Australasian Post and opened it. And there in this beautiful full-colour photo was glorious Carlotta as part of Blaze Girls. And there was, the tagline was, once there was a boy called Ricky. And I just went, closed the magazine, put it down, and looked around to see if anybody had seen the look of delight that came across my face to recognise that there was someone else like me who was out there and visible and in the media. And, you know, it was extraordinary. But it still seemed like an impossible goal to me. Even there was this flash of, oh my God, it's possible. You know, there are other people like me for a start. Wow. And then, my God, it's impossible. It's possible to live as a woman. But then quickly put away because of the recognition that she was living in the milieu of King's Cross, of Abe Saffron, and who was a leading gangster. But, you know, she was part of that scene, part of a criminal underworld that I couldn't see myself wanting to mix in.
It certainly wasn't an ordinary life. It was all very exotic, and I can imagine as a young...
Yeah, the only choices you had as a trans person probably were you know, unless you could, you know, were probably drag queen or prostitute, unless you could be a superstar model like someone like April Ashley. But
hi, you're listening to Word for Word, and I'm speaking to Michelle McNamara.
Going back to my school, though, I was certainly very good at school, and, you know, this is part of the story was... When I looked at, saw Carlotta, I thought, well, that's all very well, but you want to do something with your brain, you want to do something intellectual, and you will kind of struggle to do that if you come out. You won't be accepted. And that would almost certainly have been true, you know. It would have been a very difficult life. And when you look at the life stories of people like Carlotta or Georgina Byers, the New Zealand parliamentarian, and Sandra Pankhurst, the woman about whom The Trauma Cleaner was written, all those life stories involve violence against them. And
there's a lot of trauma in those stories.
Difficult, really difficult existences, you know, quite shockingly difficult existences. And in many ways, looking at that, I'm glad I didn't even think about attempting to do something like that. Coming out would just been so impossible. But of course, yeah, so I made use of my brain. I put away the idea of being female and took refuge in sex and drugs and rock and roll, I guess is the way. And it was quite literally like that, you know. And we've got to remember this is the late 60s, early 70s, so it was almost de rigueur to take your refuge in those things as a young teenager. And it was quite an exciting period in many ways, but, you know, I put away the whole idea of being female. And
so you just didn't think of it at all? It just was not something that passed your desk very often?
Well, that's exactly right. It was suppressed extremely. And what happened when Lou Reed put out Transformer, the album, was just such a... Oh, my God. That was another kind of one of those moments, like opening the Australasian Post, seeing Carlotta, was listening to Walk on the Wild Side and saying, these are my people. And, you know, in recent years, a Canadian university group of trans students pinged that song for being transphobic, and because shaved her legs and then he plucked her eyebrows on the way, shaved her legs and then he was a she. And I just, that just kind of describes it, you know. For me, it doesn't seem transphobic. It seems like how it was at those days.
Yeah, I think so. A lot of those cultural references do, you know, the aspect of acceptance does change, and what does seem, I guess, transphobic now. Certainly, if, you know, for you, that was something to seize on because you can't be what you can't see. So, you know, this was like, oh, my God, there's something in a song. I'm seeing Carlotta in a magazine. But you moved towards science, which, you know, it probably still is quite a masculine area to move into. What drew you to science?
Well, I guess I felt because I had to suppress my feelings about being female, being a woman, and really hide them, that this was somehow shameful, this was somehow wrong. That's a very deep-seated feeling, and it's still got, I've still got to work through that today. You know, I carry it with me right at this minute. I've got to work through that. But it seemed to me that I could not trust my feelings, you know. So in things where, in areas where like literature or history or any of the other liberal arts where opinions and feelings mattered, I felt, God, can I even give expression to my own feelings in that space? And I thought, no, and I'm quite good at science and I like rationality, I like facts. Give me a subject area or a discipline where I can go out and, you know, rely on objective evidence. Now, of course, science is got a, it's almost phantom-like that it can. There's all sorts of aspects and context to science and that makes it not absolutely fact. I recognize that now, but it was much more comfortable thing for me to do than being relying on my opinions and feelings. So that was being pushed in some ways by that. I don't think it was particularly conscious, but I definitely started to grab hold of more the facts. I certainly still do enjoy, you know, the liberal art kind of subjects, but it's something that science is something that I've held on to because it's, you know, you can go to verifiable facts and deal with them much more easily than you can in any other area. Just the whole Lou Reed episode is very, very interesting because around that time, well, David Bowie produced The Transformer, of course, but David Bowie was doing all his gender bending at that time, and there were others around too. And what that led to in my cohort of uni students was a whole lot of cross-dressing parties, you know, where, you know, I used to go along and take great delight in doing it, but people would say to me, oh, gee, Michael, you make such a good girl. And I'd go, oh, dear, they're going to find out that I'm trans and I don't want them to because it's shameful, they'll ridicule me, you know.
So there was at that stage of your life, it was, you know...
I was still frightened.
Yeah, and it was a performative thing. Like, you know, you just happened to be around when people were having cross-dressing parties and David Bowie was... You know, that sort of non-gender, that sort of genderqueer thing was happening. You know, even sort of heavy metal bands are wearing makeup and giant hair and that sort of thing. So
that was a year or two later, but they were getting there. I think, you know, I think, but even more, you know, when you listen to the words of Transformer, it was about trans women living in Andy Warhol's factory, verifiable historical people that, you know, Holly Golightly and Candy Darling, and a couple of others. And, you know, these were real trans people and they were being sung about. Fellatio was being sung about on the radio. It was quite extraordinary. But these people were people. But I just felt that might be possible in Andy Warhol's factory in New York, and it might be possible to go out in the street in New York about that like that, but do it in Melbourne, in my group, forget it, you know.
You entered into science,
yep.
And then you married.
Yes.
I'm still married,
and I'm still married to the same person. We've been together, I think we've counted up 43 years. We've been married 38 next year, 37 this year, yeah, that's right, so... We've been together for a long time.
Did you meet at university?
We met through a university friend. I was still at university. My wife was working at that stage as a photographer in a dark room. So she had finished her course. She's a little bit older than me. We were just friends for a little bit of while and we got together after a couple of years of bumping into each other and knowing each other a little bit.
And what was the status of your gender in your mind at that stage? Like when you met her, was there a sense that, can I go down this route if I feel that there's a woman lurking around, or was it still, you know, you were still in a state of suppression?
I was still in a state of total suppression, you know. It rose up in the literary transformer period for just a brief few moments. I got a few moments in the sun, but got stomped on again by me, you know, my own internalized transphobia, my own fear of being bashed, being ridiculed, not being able to hold down a job, have a house, live a normal life, quote unquote, you know, the heteronormative got to me, I guess.
And so,
you know, it was so well suppressed that I didn't really consider it. I did sneak into heels occasionally and sneak into underwear occasionally. You know, it's kind of the little female thing got out, got a little bit of an outing every now and again, but really rarely. It was really kind of really hard for me. It just felt so wrong, so difficult to do. And I just made a decision, I guess, that I never made a decision that I'd settle down and have a family. I made a decision that I wanted to be with, have relationships. So I had relationships with women before my current partner. So that's when I said I took my refuge in sex, drugs and rock and roll. It was pretty exclusively female, not totally female, but pretty much women. And by the time I'd met my wife, I'd settled down to being exclusively female, people that I was related to. Yeah, I guess, you know, we kind of both said fairly early on in our relationship that we'd had difficult childhoods, you know, and I had difficult childhood because I've been trans, but I didn't tell her that about that. But I had a difficult enough childhood anyway, having strictly religious parents and not totally sharing their ideas about life and about politics and so on was difficult. And she'd had a difficult childhood too, and I won't speak about that here, that's her prerogative, but she'd had a difficult childhood too. And I think we said, no, we'll delay having, we won't have children, we just don't think that it's, that we're appropriate people to come in children. And her clock, her internal body clock, kept ticking along, and she got to the age, ripe old age of 31 or 32, and said, it's time, I want a child, how about we get married? And so we got married, just simply on the grounds that it would help a child to have parents, you know, to have married parents, sorry. Got married, and 9 months later, along came my daughter. And it was a difficult birth, so it took another 3 years to persuade Barb to have another one, and then we had my son, so that was nice. And so we're a family, and I, having made the decision, having Barb having said I want a child, I having made the decision I want to be with Barb, therefore I was going to devote myself to being a father, making decisions on my life that were based around my responsibility to them,
That structure, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so it's a nuclear family.
Yeah. So you had several decades of career, family,
yep.
You were bringing up kids, you were married.
Yeah.
At what stage, Michelle, did you come to terms with the fact that you're actually a woman? And you've known that since you were...
Yeah. Let's describe.
Let's step forward a bit.
So there are a couple of things, and one I've touched on already, but I'll come back to it. So my father died in 2012. Just before he died, a respected Buddhist teacher of mine died, who I kind of really, really still do revere. And just about a year later, my mother died. There was kind of that's often a watershed for people who are trans, often a watershed for all sorts of people, but with regard to trans people, it can be a watershed. And also I'd been doing this Buddhist practice where I'd been, you know, we touched on it before, it's a Buddhist practice that asks you to interrogate the nature of reality, and part of that is interrogating your own nature. What am I? Am I, you know, and you might ask questions like, well, am I a husband, father, son? And I asked all these male-gendered questions of myself. Am I the work that I do, the car that I own, the house that I own, the thoughts that I have, you know, the career that I've had, all those aspects of you? And you know, is there anything inherent about them that's real? And stripping away all of them was interesting. You know, the idea is, the concept is in Buddhism is that we don't have any absolute natures, that all these things just arise from causes and conditions. And when those causes and conditions stop, then something else can arise. You know, another cause and condition will arise. Something can change, and change quite dramatically. And this thought wasn't floating around in my head in regards to being trans in any conscious way. And there was no conscious thought that when my mother died that that was the last thing holding me to being male. But she was quite a frightening woman. You know,
how do you think they would have dealt with your...
I think mum wouldn't have coped at all, and Dad would have gone along with what Mum said. It's quite simple. There were all these things piling up, and then all of a sudden, 1 month after my mother died, I found myself compelled to, buy some female clothes, to get someone to help me make up. And I decided, made the, you know, part of the whole process of going that month was selecting the female name. So Michelle. So I was out in the street as Michelle, and I said, Michelle, what the hell's going on here? You know, it was almost there was no conscious, you're trans, you need to come out. It was just you are going to come out, being compelled. And it was almost, I had to be reflective about it to say, oh yeah, you've always been trans, that's why you're doing this. You know, it's suddenly giving expression to something that's been hidden for so long.
Yeah. Was it terrifying?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I was out in Bourke Street the first day I was dressed properly and made up properly. I was out down there in Myers and Target, just across the road from here, buying clothes because I desperately needed clothes. I had one dress and one pair of shoes and one jacket at that stage. So.
That's quite a leap to having decades of suppression to, you know, as you say, your parents died. A little bit of freedom there somehow, you know, mentally, psychologically. Talk me through what happened. So you've sort of come out to yourself, really, and Michelle has been born, I guess.
Yeah.
And when did Michelle become something that other people knew about? So, if you know, for example, your wife, who was the first person you told outside of your own self?
So I linked up with Seahorse, and, you know, so I went to some of their cafe nights and meetings and so on. So I made some friends that way, made friends with queer people on Facebook. I certainly did, but I don't think that was the first thing. I certainly made friends outside as Michelle only, you know, so that wasn't the Michael. Any of Michael's friends didn't know about Michelle for quite some time. The first person who knew Michael, who knew Michelle, was my wife, Barb. And I got a text from someone, and I'm just trying to, I can't think how I met them. I don't think it was through I think it was through Facebook rather than Seahorse. But anyway, I got a text on Christmas Eve on my phone, and it was one of those rotten phones that send the notification up on the screen. And I was dozing because I'd been at a party. I was dozing on the couch as Michael. My wife picks up the phone and says, you know, hi, sweetie, have a Christmas or something. And I said, oh, that's just a friend from a work colleague. And my wife said to me, I don't think so. We had buckets of people coming over for Christmas dinner the next day, and I said, well, look, let's leave it till Boxing Day to talk about this. We've got lots to do, dear. And she said, yes, okay. And Christmas night...
Very patient of her.
Indeed. She was quite concerned that I was having a relationship, I think, you know. So there are a few hints coming through from lipstick being left on things, my own lipstick being left on things and stuff like that. But, you know, so Christmas night I told my wife, and I said, look, I'm cross-dressing, and that's how I put it. At the time, I didn't really tell her I'm trans. I said I've always known about the side of me, and I think I just want to cross-dress once a week or something like that. And that was kind of...
Small steps.
I didn't have any real sense of where I was going with it anyway myself at that stage. It was only 3 months after I first came out, so it was still forming in my own mind. And she said, okay, here's how it's going to be. I don't want any of Michelle's stuff in the house. I don't want any of her clothes, jewelry, makeup, nothing. I don't want to see any photos of her. I don't want to see her.
Did she have any idea at all? Like, did anything kind of click with her that,
nope.
Oh, he was interested in my nope. shoes or
nope.
nothing?
No. And no, she didn't really have any clues. That came like a bullet from nowhere at her. Hit her kind of between the eyes. She was quite adamant. Gradually, I mean, 6 months later, we were going out to a trans friend's party at her house with me as dressed as Michelle, and her sitting along the passenger seat beside me saying, what if the police pull us over, dear? And I said, this is perfectly legal. I just show them my license and tell them my name's Michael McNamara, and that's fine, you know. She goes, oh, really? Okay.
So she's jumped on board. She's come along for the journey.
Yeah, it was a long period. I would say it took a fully 4 or 5 years before she was really totally accepting of me. But I think, you know, I think I'd have to say she's as accepting of me as I am of me, maybe.
That's a really good point to put it,
you know.
Yeah,
it's
a really
how
good point.
Many ways, you know, several people have said this to me in the queer community. You know, self-acceptance is the hardest thing to do. It's the hardest part of the whole journey, you know, full self-acceptance.
And you sort of need that to get the acceptance of others too, in some ways, I guess. Like, if you're sort of a bit vulnerable to your own self, it's hard if you don't get 100% from other people.
You know, my first early days, you know, going out as Michelle was quite an act of bravado, really. To put up a very confident, smiling, happy front was a little bit of an effort, but, you know, that was my main armour, you know, to be able to go out and, you know, express myself confidently and just be myself and was myself. And, you know, the Buddhist practice of understanding that everybody's got some suffering and listening to other people was a really key part. You know, meet people and everyone would have some story about a brother or a friend or something who was gay, who had AIDS, who was in the closet as trans, or, you know, there were just an extraordinary number of stories, and women would talk to me about their personal problems and all sorts of things. Just kind of blew me away, really, that because I'd invited and listened to, you know, it wouldn't just be all about me. And it's terribly hard when you first come out, because it is all about you, particularly if you've suppressed it for so long, because it's such a joy and it's so
How long after those hard. Initial forays did you start living full-time as Michelle? Like, you know, come out to your
So
workplace?
I planned to come out full-time in late 2015. I'd planned to come out that following year, but in late 2015 I'd been working casually as a lecturer at Melbourne Uni, and I was offered a half-time position, and I thought, well, I can't come out. I didn't want to come out at the start of the year. I thought I can't. Well, there were several reasons, but one of them was I thought I need some confidence from the male privilege of teaching. You know, you put a man in front of a classroom and he gets respect. You put a woman in front of the classroom and the respect drops. You can notice it. You know, my own internal self-confidence needed building up more. You know, I needed to build up my own self-confidence as Michelle to be able to do it. So, and the original plan was to come out in the middle of the year, and I thought, I don't want to come out in the middle of a teaching year, so I delayed it, and I delayed it for 2 years in the end, so I didn't finally come out at work until December 2017, which, if you recall, is immediately after that wonderful marriage equality
yes.
vote, and it was joyous to have the vote go yes. But it was hell if you were a trans person during that whole plebiscite period. It was shocking. It was just so much of that shit that was being thrown at us forever was thrown up in our face again. People on the other end of the listeners in the radio land are wondering about the problem of self-acceptance. You know, I think the thing that I always point to is that there's so much media around that ridicules trans people, that regards them as being an object of ridicule, psychopaths, deceivers, murderers. If you look at the history of film, it has a shocking history of portraying trans people in just that way. There's been a number of pieces on it. I wouldn't say lots. Julie Peters has written a PhD thesis on the subject and published a book about it. There's a wonderful film on Netflix called Disclosure, which was shown at the Sundance Film Festival at the start of the year, directed by a trans person and stars trans actors, and it discusses that whole history and shows examples from film history going right back to the earliest days of film right up to the present day. And they're just shocking.
It's really
transphobic. And when you look at that, you say, no wonder I'm having trouble accepting myself. There is so much out there that says you're an object of ridicule at the best, and at the worst, you're a psychopathic murderer. Why would you accept yourself as being trans? Horrible press to have.
Talk me through coming out to your adult children.
About 18 months after I came out to my wife, I said, look, we're going to have the children know about this. I can't creep around and hide, you know. As Michelle, I'd go to venues where they might even turn up, you know, for a start, and their friends were... I definitely run into a few friends around the place. So we got them into the room over for an afternoon tea one afternoon, and I just simply said, look, this is how it is. I'm living part-time as Michelle. Barb accepts me. I don't want to leave Barb. I still love my wife. I still love you too. And please accept me. And my son is very chilled, a very chilled sort of character, and he just said, Yeah, okay, yeah. It was sort of showing signs of apprehension. My daughter was, and I'll just describe it to the audience, was had her hands fingers interlaced and was twiddling her thumbs very nervously and looking from side to side and saying, "Yes, Dad, that's great, Dad, that's okay, Dad. No, yeah, that's fine, Dad." And the body language was tense and saying absolutely the opposite, you know, I could tell. And I think it even took my son a long time to come, a fair bit of time to come around. Interestingly, my son has a Chinese wife now, but before he married her, back in those days, he'd had another Chinese girlfriend. And both those Chinese women, you know, born in China, one was born in Indonesia, Chinese ethnic heritage, and the other born in China. Both of them accepted me totally from the get-go. They'd never known me as a male anyway, so that was pretty easy. It's a lot easier, I think, if you haven't known the person in another gender to accept them in their new gender. But that was quite good. And I think the acceptance that they showed of me really helped Patrick come along for the journey. Now he's really good. I think also he's got a few queer friends, and they've been able to help him explain, I think, some of me to him as well.
There must be so many questions as an adult child of a transgender person. That, you know, there just must be this avalanche of questions about how do we refer to you, how do we talk about you, where did this come from? There must be lots of questions. Where are you at with your daughter?
Well, she's still, you know, very edgy around me. She's better than she has. She's been improving slowly. My son's improved a lot. So I decided very early on that I wasn't resiling from the fact that I was their father. And I just said, call me Dad. And if I write to them or send them a text, I'll often close off love, Dad. Patrick has now come to the stage of referring to me as Michelle, so I can now happily sign off a text, love, Michelle. Because he uses that name all the time in preference to Dad. But Nikki is kind of still at that stage of it's got to be Dad, I think. You know, it's a lower level of acceptance. I mean, I can use that as a barometer of acceptance, if you like.
I guess, you know, we can't speak for your daughter either, but perhaps...
I can't. It's too complex, too complex.
No, we don't want to. But I guess I'm just sort of, you know, big picture. Maybe it's hard to let go. That's a sense of loss if you stop calling your dad, Dad. Maybe that's a little bit of a sense of loss in terms of that label that means a lot in terms of a parent. You know, just sort of that historical thing of if you've been speaking to someone, yeah, referring to them as Dad.
I mean, Nikki's very funny, you know. She have had lots of friends who, I guess, that were children of single mothers or whose father had left the family. And, you know, they'd often latch on to me and, you know, perhaps say, you know, call me Michael or Mick. And if I said that to any of her friends that were in that category, Nikki would say, you can call him Dad. You can't call him anything but Dad. He's Dad. And so she's got a very strong image, had a very strong image of me, and we were quite close when she was younger. So it's a very strong bond that has been somewhat sundered there. I must say, going on to the sense of loss, that my own, when I did finally transition, so the proper legal change of name came in November. The 1st of December, I came out at work totally in 2017. That around that period, I felt this great sense of loss. You know, there was like I was killing off Michael, who'd carried Michelle inside him all these years, had dealt with being a male, putting on a male mask, pretending to be male, and keeping Michelle safe, keeping her safe. And he was a he, and he was now gone, and a real sense of loss. And I really, you know, I said to my wife, let's go out and have a dinner to kind of commiserate with me about the loss. You know, I wanted to do something, feel about it. And a whole year went past. It wasn't until 2019 that I figured out that the Buddhist group that I'm part of now has a ceremony on the Parinirvana of Buddha, which is, I think, the 19th of February. It's in February. So February 2019... I decided to do a ceremony. They have a ceremony where you light a candle and they read out a name of a person and your relationship to them, and you light the candle for them and remember them and then let them go as the candle goes out. And I said, all right, I want to remember Michael. And the person doing the ceremony said, okay, we want to read out the relationship. What is Michael to you? And I go, I said, wow. I don't know what to say. Please don't say anything. And so the person said, Michael, who's known to Michelle, who was known to Michelle. And I think that was a nice. So I think he actually figured out what I was on about, that Michael had been me.
That sense of tribute is quite a beautiful thing, really. You know, the way you speak about Michael is that, you know, he carried you through and he nourished Michelle over time. And, that you sort of given him a tribute and...
Let him go.
I needed
to. You know, it was very much when I did decide that I had to put my female self away, that I had to manufacture a male persona, that I had to study how to be a man, how to behave like a man, Because the reason I was being picked on in the bullying that I referred to earlier was because I was showing feminine gestures, feminine movements. You know, the ways in which we read people's gender is really quite subtle and really quite well. So it's deeply grounded and it's quite extraordinary.
You're now really active in a lot of queer and trans organisations. I've got a little list here. Committee member of Transgender Victoria, committee member of the Australian LGBTIQ+ Multicultural Council, committee member of Queers in Science. You're the staff co-representative on the Pride in Action Network Committee and the member of the Faculty of Science Diversity and Inclusion Committee, just to name a few. How important is that sort of visibility in terms of helping others sort of take the journey that you have?
Look, there was very shortly after I came out, I made this conscious decision, thinking about the situation with trans people, that trans people suffered from lack of visibility and that the more visible I could be, the better. You know, if I could be very visible, it would certainly help someone else. You know, just even that glimpse of Carlotta meant that I wasn't completely completely crazy, that I wasn't totally alone in the world, that there were other people like me, and it was just so important. And it's just so hard, was so hard to have that visibility. It's a bit easier now, but the more of us that are out there, the more people that know a trans person, the more likely they are to accept that trans people have rights, that trans people need to be supported. And I think it's just so much, so important for me to be as visible as I can, to be the best person that I can as a trans person, but to be visibly trans and allow people to see that, to allow people to see. So often those stories in the media are of trans people, even if they're not ridiculed or psychopaths, they're stories of tragedy. They're stories of someone who's a victim, who's murdered, who has a really difficult life, goes crazy. What we don't see is stories of trans people having moderately successful lives or successful lives. We only ever see a very few superstars. We don't see that middle rank of people that are living normal, quote-unquote, lives.
Quietly in the burbs.
And I don't want to be quiet about it, but I want people to see me. And I want to see people that I am living in the burbs and that I am... I'm living a good and happy life.
I didn't know you before. I only met you today. There's a settled confidence about you.
Greater than what I had as Michael, because there was always something that was being held back. It might have been buried deep. It might have been hidden under 40 years of practice of being a male. But there was always a woman underneath who wanted to get out. And now that she is out, I'm much more comfortable. As Michelle than I was as Michael, you know.
Well, Michelle, just an incredible story, and you know the fantastic aspect that I'm taking away from this is the aspect of the visibility for you, and it's really important for you to be visible, and I think it's really important for people to see you and to see that you can be successful, maintain a relationship, have relationships with adult children and your friends and neighbours. And I just want to say thank you for all the efforts that you go to be out and proud, and you know, Michelle is front and centre, and I think it's fantastic. And yeah, I'm full of admiration for your journey, and congratulations on getting there in the end, I guess.
Thank you so much, Lizzie. Yes, to encapsulate what you just said, you can't be what you can't see, and I'm desperately wanting people to be able to see me.
Well, I see you.
And, thank you.
Full of admiration. Thank you.
Thank you.
This episode is now available for download as a podcast. You can find this episode and the entire back catalogue of Word for Word episodes across the seasons on iTunes and Spotify, or download directly from the Joy website, joy.org.au. While you're at it, head over to the Word for Word Facebook page to keep up to date with news and episodes. Joy Podcasts, where you want them, when you want them.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Lisa Daniel from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 stations across the community radio network.
Experiencing difficulty, please reach out for support. You can reach QLife, an anonymous and free LGBTI support service, by calling 1800 184 527 or call Lifeline 24 hours a day on 131114 for crisis support and suicide prevention. In an emergency, please call 000.
Not the crap that I've been to feel. I'm on the edge and bearing up. straight out of the sun. The circus, Malo Revolta, Finns, a circus.